Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Can't Cop the Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I am the son, Eric Payne.
And I'm the mother, I'm Kate Thompson, and welcome everyone. We have a big show for you tonight. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a surprise for you. Not really a surprise, but we're going to be interviewing our other co-host, Wayne Gilman. And as you may know, many of you may know that Wayne was the news director for WLIB, WBLS, you know, several years ago. And we worked together intensely on a number of different police community cases. As a matter of fact, WLIB was one of the leading stations dealing, you know, with police community relations and also, you know, the things happening in the African-American community. And I'm talking about them and referring, really, to the cases of, you know, in Ferguson with young Mike Brown being gunned down by a police person, and also Eric Gardner from Staten Island being choked to death by a New York Police Department. And, of course, as you know, since last week and the week before and several other days, I think, the country is in an uproar with a lot of, you know, demonstrations and protests, and rightly so, because of the fact that police-community relationships must improve. And it seems that in a lot of areas of the country, that particular area of policing has not been addressed in order to address properly. It seems like every single month, just about, or even more than that, there is either a killing or something involving police persons in the Black and Latino communities and several other communities. So what we want to do is to talk to Wayne about several cases that, you know, he worked on and he knows of and when he was news director at WLRB, because we got all that information right from the people who were involved, because they couldn't get adequate time on any of the major networks. And that was in the late 60s and 70s. When I was at LRB, I think it was in the late 70s or was it 80s, Eric?
I believe it was in the late 70s and early 80s.
Early 80s, right. So we're going to be talking to Wayne.
Wayne is with us. Hey, Wayne.
Hey, good evening, folks. How's everyone?
Everybody's doing fine. How's the weather there? Are you snowed in yet?
It's coming down. I'm glad that I was able to spare myself the trip over there tonight. And you know, I was just listening to you, Kay, a moment ago. I mean, it sounds like we're dating ourselves, but it's hard to believe that we've been through all this in the last 30 to 40 years of broadcasting.
Isn't it amazing that we seem to be going full circle?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, there was an interesting report that was released today about the status of race relations in this country, and there's a perception that things have gotten worse under the leadership of the first African-American president. And I don't know. I mean, they were saying that there was a juxtaposition between things being better under Bush as opposed to what is happening currently. But I think we're going through a reawakening now that we have not seen on the order of protest. And I'd like to think that in spite of the polls showing a lack of distrust for the police department in the Black community, and certainly there are some elements who are not necessarily in the progressive white community, obviously, that feel that the police are doing their job and they're doing it appropriately. I think that we're at a precipice for realignment in this country in political thinking. I think the way young people of all sorts of ethnic backgrounds are coming out and staging these demonstrations and sit-ins and die-ins and the and you know just the uproar that's going on. I've never witnessed anything like this in my lifetime, and it's very inspiring to see that these are the children of people that you've given birth to, Kay, because I'm childless at this age. At least I don't know of anyone that I. You know, that I have impregnated at this point, if I may be personal for a minute. But the deal is just that, you know, it's a refreshing change to see what is taking place here now. And I'd like to think that things will eventually get better.
Yeah, and, you know, go ahead,
Eric. Yeah, I was going to say, Wayne, it is ironic that with the first African-American president, it seems like some people would like to characterize it as things that have gotten worse. I just think that... that old racist guard really came to the forefront or rose, bubbled over to the top to really kind of really show how racist they were, and they just lost their mind. I don't think things got worse under Obama. I think all of those people just really kind of lost their mind and didn't know how to react. And I kind of was thinking about that as well.
Yeah.
It seems that with a black president that all these white cops, the ones that were racist, wanted to really go after black men. And I, too, like you, was encouraged. I got to preface that to say I was discouraged to be very militant and anti and to see what they're doing to us and white and make it a white and black thing. But in witnessing these protests and seeing not just young people, but even older white folks that are justice-seeking people who are good and decent people and reasonable people have been out there protesting. I'm in Montclair, New Jersey. I was driving the other day past my nephew's old middle school early in the morning, and they had kids out there protesting on the corner with signs talking about Black Lives Matter and things like that. So, and this is a relatively diverse community, and so I've been kind of out of this turmoil. It's come a new direction of America. I think that this new generation, the generation that lived to see and vote in the first African-American president, the generation that came out in numbers. I'm talking about the young people now. They're really pushing an agenda forward. It seems an agenda forward that says that we're going to move towards a post-racial world. And that's been inspiring to me to see that. And also, too, to see, just to see the other day where you had the cop that had to shoot the guy in the Jewish community center, everybody saw that, you know, that was something that couldn't have been avoided. But you did see the cops even at least exercise restraint in terms of how many bullets they fired. So I guess there's progress in small incremental amounts.
Yeah, and you know, I think I also have a different take on it with the president, with the first African-American president. I think that he was there for a reason. Okay, and remember that these protests and these demonstrations, and these demonstrators coming out in large numbers and large groups from here to California to the West Coast, California down to the southern states, all over the country, you know, just happened to be under the wing of I'm trying to think of the word I want. U.S. under the presidency of a black president. And I think because of that, that may have something to do with the fact that this is a time that should have come a long time ago. And when you remember a number of different cases that, you know, that everybody was so upset about, but nothing was done about it. I'm thinking about the case with Amadou Diallo, and we've all heard of that. In fact, we were on the air that happened, when this young man was shot 41 times. And the police had almost lined up in front of his house that he was going into, and he was shot. And we're also talking about there was a man named Buchanan out there in Arizona, you know, because he was on Geraldo's show with me when, you know, Geraldo was on CBS. And he had a couple of sons, and one of them was shot by state police out there, or if I may be mistaken out there, the members of the police department out there in Arizona. And then there was the Central Park Five blamed for something they didn't do. And some of the members of the police department knew, you know, those boys had nothing to do with it. So, and then we're talking about so many other things, and we haven't even gotten reports about the American Indians who have been, you know, harassed in different states. So I think this is a topic that really, and a thing that we have to deal with, and it just happened to come under the auspices of the black president. Isn't that interesting? That tells me that
it is interesting, Kay, and you're absolutely right. I mean, there's such a vast history. I mean, you know, I go back to my beginning as a cub reporter, just covering different demonstrations. You know, even in Brooklyn, one of my very first assignments, I was covering a demonstration in the Canarsie section of Brooklyn. At that particular time, Canarsie was not even gentrified as it is now. It was mostly a Jewish neighborhood, and I remember, you know, just being one of one or two color covering a story amid other people out there about busing, the fact that there was a lack of quality education in certain districts, and kids that needed to get the quality education had to go into districts that most whites did not at that particular time approve of in the city of New York. And Brooklyn was a completely different culture way back then. But one of my first assignments, there was a woman that saw who I was working for, saw the call letters on my microphone, and spat on me. That was my first, that was my baptism by fire, getting into this whole racial conflict. Because the deal is that I, at that particular time, we're talking about the early 1970s, I had come out of an area in Brooklyn that was predominantly African American. Bedford-Stuyvesant was considered the largest concentration of blacks in this country outside of the South, you know, and the deal is that at that particular time it was regarded as the ghetto. I mean, if you go through there now, it's completely gentrified. I could count probably on one palm people of color who I grew up with who are there now. Most of I still have family in the neighborhood, and most of my family's neighbors are all white. And the cultures have changed. There's just been a completely different dynamic that is going on in the city, but it just took the myriad of demonstrations, the killings. I mean, there's so many things that we've lived through. You talk about Amadou Diallo. What about the situation with Abner Louima, the little black book that WLIB was branded for by the New York City Police Department? There were times when back in the night. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Eric. There was a little black book that the New York City Police Department in the 1980s would keep record of every broadcast that we would do on WLIB about stories of racial controversy. And the thing is that the police, this was under Edward Koch, and Koch, I don't care. I mean, we had Giuliani, who I thought was the epitome of polarization and the epitome of racism, of being, you know, you branded him last week, Eric, as Rudy the Racist. You know, I thought he was bad. But Koch had a subtlety about him, you know, and I don't know really what really led, you know, to his motivation, because when he was a member of Congress, he was far more progressive. He was amongst the civil rights leaders demonstrating in places like Selma, Alabama, and all that stuff. But the minute he was elected mayor of New York City, there was a polarization that occurred here that I had never witnessed before during the course of my time living in this town. And it was like, that's what
you're talking about. You could talk about
I'm talking
Rudy.
About Edward Koch. I mean, this is prior to Dinkins being elected mayor, prior to Rudolph Giuliani succeeding Dinkins.
Right, right.
But there were differences that went on. I can't even think of the young man's name, but Kay, I know you were there when we covered that huge killing, which really sounded the death knell on Koch's reelection back in 80. The young man in East New York who was shot to death, and God, you know, having a senior moment. But, you know, the deal is that I remember the volumes of people that turned out for that demonstration. If I'm not mistaken, it was the Reverend Sharpton and the former, God forgive me, the Minister of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, who gave a eulogy for that day. And And you know, the one thing is that there was such a huge turnout for that demonstration and that funeral procession, but the whole racial dynamic within the city changed. But the thing is, the fact that, you know, that a police department would devote so much time to a little stinking 30,000-watt radio station in Harlem, well, we had already moved out of Harlem into Midtown Manhattan at that particular time. It was amazing that this stuff was going on, and that there were times when I know that my phone at home was tapped. You know, the phones of my colleagues were tapped. And,
okay,
you know, this COINTELPRO activity involving just...
Wayne, let me stop you right there, because... Just to bring people that may not know the parameters of what you're saying, let's kind of go back to the beginning of the story, at least, because you're kind of in the middle a little bit. So you're saying that at the time you guys were on the air, that the New York City Police Department had like a little black book in which they were monitoring all of the stories that WLIB was doing that comprised racial controversy. Was it just WLIB or was it the black radio station?
No, it was largely WLIB, because we had turned into a talk station and we were dealing with subjects that people spoke about, but basically it was kitchen table talk in the homes of most African Americans and Latino households in the New York tri-state area. And I think the reason why LIB was branded, because it had such a huge signal. You could reach six states. It covered, you know, the tri-state area. It was the center of the dial. And the thing is, we were competitive, and your mother is a witness to this, to people like Bob Grant from WABC, later Sean Hannity. You know, there was competition from all the conservative white talk radio stations. And
they were very much aware of WLIB and the impact it was having at that time, right, for these other white hosts to make fun of you, right?
Yeah,
right.
They tried to downplay it. As a matter of fact, the people over there at ABC Radio, they really were, you know, having a fit about it. There was I remember Bob Grant. Remember him? He was so vicious and anti-black that it was funny. You know,
he made a huge living that way.
Yes, he did. And that's what the races do. But you know, I think everything has its time. And this is the time for a big change. Okay? You're only going to be putting up with something like racism for a period of time. And then it has to blow up. And that's exactly what's happening now. But mainly because of the fact that the social media is involved. And I'm glad that it is. Because of the fact that some of these people can see exactly what's going on. We're doing someone, it's almost like a portion or part of slavery. Because if you look at the numbers of people incarcerated, and you look at the white numbers, and you look at the black numbers, you know that? People say, well, you're killing each other. Well, Giuliani, shut up, because you're one of the people who, you know, have put innocent blacks in jail. And plus the fact that the conditions are so awful. I'm going to bring in somebody that, you know, knows a lot about incarceration and the lady out of state, and I still have to get some information, and we're going to bring it to everyone. But racism is really, you know, it's a disease, you know, and so these
it
young
is.
People are really reacting to it, and they're reacting to police brutality. So goodness sakes, we're helping to pay their salaries. Okay, and I'm not talking about all police. I'm talking about those who know, you know, that they don't like people of a certain color. Fine, you can like who you want to like. Just don't get my money, pay my taxes, and, you know, and live off, you know, your negative thoughts, you know, off of me, you know?
But going back to what you were talking about, Wayne, in terms of those days you guys were kind of being surveilled and stuff like that, that would mean, I'm supposing, as I think about what you're saying, is that you guys were making such an impact that probably what that meant was that they felt they needed to monitor you guys because you were the link or there for the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're absolutely right. They felt that we were inflaming. You know, Eric, I go back to a time in radio when, particularly on WLIB, where they never even thought people like, I'm just going to say randomly, Ivory Soap would never buy time on a station like WLIB because they felt that black folks didn't wash. They didn't use soap. You know, they just put water on themselves and that was it. And the thing is that, you know, if you were to Google tonight, there was a Madison Avenue study that was done some years ago. In fact, Reverend Sharpton, this is during the Clinton administration when this was conducted, and it just showed the mindset of the major advertisers about what they thought in terms of spending money on stations like WLIB and WBLS. Well, when BLS took off, it had such a crossover effect. No, it was the biggest Cinderella story in radio. No one ever thought that they would have such mass appeal. But, even today, I just even wonder with all the competition that's out there now with the Internet, satellite radio and stuff like that, what happened when that station blew up, you know, blew up favorably, that it was the station of choice by everybody unanimously. You know, I don't know if that could be repeated again today. LIB was a completely different animal because it was almost like as if you were leaving something that was very cosmopolitan, and of course the programming on BLS was slightly different. It was still black based. There was always that pride there, and of course backed up by the pride of the black ownership. But the direction that they were going after under the tutelage of Frankie Crocker was to have mass appeal. And, right. You know, but the thing is what happened with LIB, you know, talk shows like Your Mother's Talk Show, Gary Bird, Mark Riley, everyone else who had a show on LIB dealing with the matters of the day, the constant bombardment of racial profiling and people being stopped on the streets, unfortunately arrested, you know, the nonsense that Abner Louima, this Haitian who was stopped by, it was the only time in which a grand jury, and I can think in recent memory where a white cop is to this day doing time for sticking a nightstick up a black man's rectum to prove a point about who's powerful. You know, other than that, there's, to my knowledge, there's always been that symbiotic relationship between the police department, the senior management of the police department, grand juries, and the prosecutor's office in the local districts. I know how that's going to change. I mean, your cousin was on the air last week, Congressman Payne, and he was suggesting that there's got to be an official federal special prosecutor's office that can handle cases like this. And I'm just hoping that's the way out. Because we just witnessed this way too many times, and clearly from coast to coast, and even overseas, people are disgusted with the matter of race relations in this country.
Yeah. But, you know, it's changing. It is really changing. I'm just so angry that it's taking so long. You know, I keep thinking about the Central Park Group. You know, here we have, you know, prominent businessman, you know, who is leading this fight by putting ad, full-page ad in the Times and everything. You know, just exactly making people think these boys did this, and they ended up in jail for a period of time. I forget how many years.
Yeah, listen, don't be afraid. His name is Donald Trump. Donald Trump spent millions of dollars disgracing and doing degradation to these young men. And even to this day, he still upholds the same point of view. These kids have been cleared. There's been empirical evidence to show that these kids were not involved in that rape case, and still he wants to make a point like as if they were guilty.
So he's pursuing kind of a continued smear campaign against these kids?
Goodbye. Yeah.
I haven't heard that. I just don't think that's important right now. The money that they are supposed to be getting, the $40 million certainly is not enough for the years that they've spent in jail. And one of the key reporters on that was Anna Phillips, who at the time was working for CBS. Okay, and the policeman knew that she knew who was the person was a rapist. The policeman knew because he had connect to it. But yet they let this case go on, and let those boys, you know, go to jail. So see, everything has its time, and this is time for, you know, people to really realize that there's an unjust base, you know, core of people that want to go back to, I don't know where they want to go back to. Because whatever it is that you're going to be suppressing one group over another, it's not going to happen. Not without a fight. And what's happening
right
now, and so you really have to, I mean, it's so easy. I don't think, I'm not saying it's that easy to live together, but sane, you know, people, civilized people, can live together. But God's sake, a lot of them go to see our sports guys, you know, the football players and the basketball players, and a lot of the teams are black, a lot of the teams are white. But for goodness sakes, you know, this is outrageous to still be going through this, you know, because of race. What are you, crazy? It's not going to change.
Yeah, moving on to another subject. Go ahead, Wayne. I'm sorry.
No. It's just basically agreeing with your mom, and I don't know when it will change. I think there's slow progress, you know, and it's funny, all those people of means who, you know, like the sports figures, people of color who are now stepping up and subtly showing their support for what's going on, maybe that will, you know, take it over the top. It's just that, regrettably, we have short memories, a lot of us, and you know, there's a need for, you know, basically galvanizing the mindset of young people in our own communities. I mean, it's refreshing to see what educated people who know the country's history and want to bring about change, what they're doing politically is one thing. But, you know, whenever I turn on the TV and I see certain shows that seems to be mostly in the fore of most people for entertainment and educational consumption, you know, it's like further dumbing down our environment. You know, it's like it gets you to the point where, you know, you're not doing anything to inspire us or you know, just take us to another level in terms of elevating the conversation about, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room that needs to be let out and change. You know, it's just one of those things. But I happen to agree, you know, Kay, that it's going to probably take another generation or so before things really get to a level, if it should ever get to a level playing field.
As a New Yorker, moving to a little bit more, I mean, that's a good segue to where we are now with the current mayor of New York. How do you think that he's doing as an African-American resident and with all of the challenges? You know, because he caught a lot of flack the other day when he really identified with the plight of black parents or people as a parent of a child of color. Now, he talked about the conversation that many parents have with their young sons. And he seemed to, you know, the head of the Policemen's Benefit Association really seemed to take issue with the fact that the mayor was really being quite realistic and blunt. I watched him on this week with George Stephanopoulos this Sunday, and, you know, he was talking about really need to have some blunt conversation in this country about these things. And I think he's right, but I don't live there. So you as a New Yorker, what's your perspective?
I have to agree, you know, on a personal level. I had an opportunity to work for de Blasio once, and I'm really sorry that I never followed up with it because I really didn't know much about him politically at the time. I knew that he was somebody, a mover and shaker in the Dinkins administration, but, you know, it wasn't until, you know, he was elected, I had a chance to see the family, and I think he gets it because of what he's married into, and his concerns for his own children, you know, what they will face, because what they will face wouldn't be something what he would face. And it hits home. Obviously, he gets it. And I just think he's in a tough spot because, you know, he has gotten an overwhelming amount of support from the African-American community, Latino community. But the deal is that because he is involved in a racially mixed relationship, I think that, you know, there's a certain conservative element of whites in this city that just aren't really ready to embrace the progressive things that he's already done to bring about a meaningful change here. And the deal is that he's also taken a certain amount of criticism from some of the black leadership about his handling of the police department under Bill Bratton. And, you know, Bratton was here before. Largely he is responsible for the implementation of Safe Streets, Safe City when Dinkin was mayor. But then, you know, he had a falling out with Giuliani after Dinkins lost his re-election bid, and he stayed on. And, of course, you know, anyone who did not politically align himself with that conservative element with Giuliani, they were given the boot. So he left, went to L.A., became police commissioner there.
So you're saying, you know, you kind of confused me. You said Bratton had a falling out after Dinkins and Giuliani?
Yeah. In other words, Bratton was inherited by Giuliani after Dinkins left office. Dinkins ran for a second term and he lost.
Right, Dave, so you're saying that, because this is new to me, or maybe I don't remember, I kind of forgot that, because I thought that Bratton came to town under at the request or offering of the job by Rudy Giuliani, but you're saying that David Dinkins brought him to town?
Yeah, he was largely responsible for that program, Safe Streets, Safe City.
Right. But what I'm asking is, was that under the what I'm confused about, or what I was ignorant to the fact, was that it was under David Dinkins. I thought that Bratton came to be police commissioner of New York under the Rudy Giuliani administration. I thought that Rudy brought him down.
No. I mean, it was a transfer of power, you know, as in, like, with what happened with Ray Kelly and under Bloomberg, you know, there was a transfer of power. And the deal is that Bratton was not allowed, because there was a fallout between the two of them in terms of how to police the city. And I'm jogging my memory now, but I know there was an issue over Bratton's position regarding the taking over of Temple Number 7 up in Harlem under the Nation of Islam. There was that big scene in which police stormed the temple once, and I forgot the circumstances around that. You know, there were issues that in which Giuliani was showing a heavier hand and devoting attention to what he felt were quality of life issues as opposed to the major issues. But basically what he was feeding on was a foundation that started with Dinkins, you know?
I see.
And I'm jogging my memory now. But,
I was under the impression that Bill Bratton came to town, that Giuliani, as mayor, hired Bill Bratton to be police commissioner in New York. And I didn't know that. I thought that wasn't – then when was Ben Ward? He was police commissioner.
Ben Ward was under Koch, and Ben Ward was also – had a hand – because remember, after Ward – there was Lee Brown that Dinkins brought in from Texas.
Right.
And he went back to Texas. But Ben Ward, regrettably, was involved with that little black book situation regarding WLIB.
Right.
That was under Koch's watch when Koch was mayor. And there was a progression. It went from Ward, there was Lee P. Brown, you know, who did an admirable job. And he left to go back, I believe he was from Texas, and he got an opportunity to go there. And towards the end of the Dinkins administration, as he sought to seek another term, if my memory serves, I think he brought Bratton in from Boston, and there was a feeling that Bratton was somewhat progressive, but Bratton could not get along with Giuliani, and that was the issue. He put the kibosh on that. And, of course, you know, he hired Bernard Carrick, and Carrick's history speaks for itself.
Right, because Bratton, I know, left after Giuliani's first term, right? That's correct, right? I'm pretty positive that he left after. I'm pretty positive that they left after the first term. Let's see.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was before, but, you know, maybe you're right there. I'm trying, because so much has happened, and there's so much to keep abreast of. But, I mean, if we were to Google that, I'm certain, you know, the time frame might be, the time sequence is probably around that. But I know that, you know, he was unhappy with Bratton, and then he brought his boy Bernard Carrick in, who was head of the corrections police, because at that time, everybody was fragmented. They had the housing police, you had the transit police. Everybody had different divisions. And then Bloomberg, you know, changed all that and made everyone a cop. Didn't matter, you know, what division you worked in.
Yeah, I kind of Wikipedia'd it, and clearly they're wrong about their information because this has Bratton starting with the NYPD 94 to 96, but we know that he was there prior to that, correct?
Yeah, I believe so. Maybe I'm wrong, you know. I mean, the deal is that I just know that there was a capitalization on Giuliani's part because crime, remember, there was an epoch in which crime in New York City was at its peak right after Koch left because there were incidents, you know, throughout the city in which it was just changing. I mean, the deal is it was just out of control. And then Dinkins implemented the Safe City, Safe Streets concept. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Bratton that heralded or shepherded part of that responsibility. And the deal is that Giuliani wanted to be remembered for it. So what he did, he started going after quality of life crimes, you know, to his credit, to bring down the crime rate. And there was a progressive change in the atmosphere in terms of New York City. But you know what? Maybe you're right, because Ray Kelly had involvement with Dinkins, you know? And I'm trying to remember, you know, when Ray was commissioner. But, you know, the deal is Ray is still branded with the stop and frisk thing. And that just seems so out of character for him.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe you're right in terms of the time sequence, but, you know, there was that involvement with Dinkins.
I want to add something else to this. The time when the minister, Louis Farrakhan, you know, was, you know, very much involved in New York's black community, whatever happened to that? Where is Minister Farrakhan now? Is he still with us?
Knowledge, he's still running the Nation of Islam. He's still the leadership. You know, at one point there was speculation that our good friend Conrad Muhammad, who is now Reverend Conrad Tillard, the pastor of a church, a prominent church in Brooklyn, you know, there was speculation that he was going to take over. And then there are others that also were being groomed to fit the bill. But to my knowledge, Minister Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, it's probably just as active, you know, in that I have not kept up with all the issues facing that particular sect. But the deal is that they're just as active as they probably once were back in the day in terms of trying to maintain a certain standard. But I haven't heard anything lately from Minister Farrakhan in a long time. The last time I actually saw something with him was during the second inauguration for Barack Obama.
Yeah. Where is the main headquarters now? Do you have any idea?
It's still in Chicago. Yeah, it's still in Chicago. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's Temple 7. It's no longer in the old location on 119th Street in Harlem, but I think it's on 138th. They took over an old church or an old school building. And if I'm not mistaken, Minister Kevin Muhammad is running that. But it's a historic temple. I mean, when you think of Harlem and the history of Harlem, one of the things that drew me into, you know, covering stories, I remember as a young man going to the Apollo Theater to see concerts. But the one thing that attracted me to Harlem was the political progression that was in that community. There was the corner of 7th Avenue and 125th Street, which was almost the Black America's Trafalgar Square. I think if memory serves, they used to call it the People's Square, and you would see people like Malcolm X, Adam Clayton Powell, all sorts of people of political notoriety in the black community giving weekly speeches on a Saturday afternoon at 12 noon, you know, gathering throngs of people just to hear them speak and talk about the issues of the day, you know?
Mm.
And I found that so fascinating because I never saw that going on in Brooklyn.
I think it was very interesting, too, around that time, if I'm not mistaken, because Dr. Ben came into existence. The first time I heard about Dr. Joseph Ben Yekinen, the noted anthropologist, who is also a lawyer, you know, and he had so many degrees, and one of the brightest men in the world, was in relationship to, let me see, when it happened. I don't really, he was on Gil Noble's show. And everybody,
right.
You know, gravitated to him because it was a period of time when you really wanted to know more about Black history and African history and, you know, the beginnings of man. And people were, you know, really questioning things in their churches because of the fact that religious beliefs were being questioned. What's your response to some of that history, Wayne?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, Kay. I mean, he was among the leading educators, along with Professor Linda Jeffries, who would hold court on that corner because it was a very historic corner. You don't see that going on today. I mean, Harlem has become so gentrified now that, you know, at the corner, other than the Hotel Teresa, I don't know what's at the corner of 125th and 7th Avenue, you know, other than the state office building on the far side. But the spot that I'm talking about is where, you know, there should be a national, it should be considered a national monument. Somebody needs to put a plaque. You know, like how in Hollywood, if you go down Los Angeles, I think it's La Cienega Boulevard, or one of those places where they got the Hollywood Walk of Fame, you know, and you see the stars. Somebody needs to put a plaque at that corner because that particular spot had such an indelible imprint on the movers and shakers of Harlem at that particular time. And basically, it was a deciding factor. Speeches that were given there basically led to a lot of changes that took on politically in this town. And again, you know, you never saw things like that going on. I mean, what has progressed to that today might be Reverend Sharpton's National Action Network up on 145th, you know, and the House of Justice that he's formed. But, I mean, this was a place where everybody would go rain or shine, snowstorms even. And it's just fascinating that, you know, when I see what is going on in Harlem, it's like the shell of what it used to be. And we all knew at some point it would go back to being, you know, what it is now. It's really unaffordable. Actually, most of New York City at this point, other than the outer boroughs, and it depends on where you go to, because Brooklyn's not one of them, you know, that where people, poor people or people of modest means could actually eke out a living, it's just become so highly expensive.
Yeah. Remember the time when Nelson Mandela came to New York? And we covered that, you know, extensively, and that was really quite a period because, you know, people were, you know, joined together, they congregated together, and that area that you're talking about, I think it was the Adam Clayton Powell building, was that it? Or the,
What I'm talking about is diagonally across from the Powell, Adam Clayton Powell State Office building. Okay. But when Mandela came, he spoke in front of the Powell, the state office building, and to throngs of New Yorkers and many well-wishers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Powerful guy.
Yeah. I remember that. That was really, really, really powerful.
Right, right. And I like to think, you know, I mean, I'm not riding off the city. I'd like to think things are going to come back to a certain extent to the way they once were, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess the one thing that I'm inspired by is that the level of protestation on the parts of everybody. I mean, we're not just talking back in the day. You had the Black Panthers, you know, you had all sorts of different political groups that came out of the Black community to bring about change. But this day, you know, because of social media and because I think there are so many progressive people who understand what's going on, even in the white community, that they themselves can align themselves with the problems that people of color go through. And, you know, when you look at the Garner case, I mean, the fact that I understand that Columbia University's law school has suspended tests this week because of the psychological impact of what's come out of that prosecution of the Eric Garner case. You know, I found that fascinating, that, you know, that so many people who are studying law have been impacted by that. That was just announced today. I'm not sure if there was a justification for it, but that's what happened.
Isn't that a good thing? Are they looking into that? Is that going to be?
Oh yeah, I think what it is that many of the students watched that and saw what was going on and the psychological impact it's had, and I guess the educators, whoever runs the law school, decided that, you know, we're going to stick a pin in this for now and allow people to recover from what has gone on and get a clear understanding, because, you know, there's so many people, even our governor, Cuomo, has come forward and said that, you know, the whole criminal justice system, jurisprudence is in shambles at this point. You know, it's not, I'm not saying that it cannot be corrected, but there's something, you know, wrong with the system. Kay, I mean, you have a family of litigators in your immediate household. You've given birth to that. I mean, I'm certain they share the same opinion after seeing what went on in Staten Island. And in Ferguson, you know.
Well, you know, I saw Glenn Beck, a clip of Glenn Beck saying he didn't know how the guy.
God.
Hold on.
Yeah.
And I saw a clip of Glenn Beck saying that he didn't know how that cop got off, that the cop should have been indicted. So I never thought I would agree
You've
with
never
Glenn
seen something
Beck.
Like that.
But even Glenn Beck said that's something that this guy should be held accountable. So that tells me that clearly. As you said, the system, there's something that needs to be changed about the system. When you have such a wide cross-section of people who never agree on anything, some of them coming out and saying that's agreeable. And also, too, if these Tea Party folks and some of these people who are real libertarians look at that, they would be in agreement that if they could get past their racism, and obviously there are some of those who are racist, not to say they're all racist. So, but they certainly understand the rights of an American citizen to not be accosted on the street by the police officers, and that kind of probably from their playbook would reflect itself or would appear to be tyranny of the government.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the answer for the Tea Party is to have a recruitment drive by the NRA to have more blacks involved in having the right to bear arms and all that business. I think that would just bring a complete halt to all the changes that are going on in the system. And you know, I say that, you know, with a certain amount of lightheartedness, for lack of a better expression. But the bottom line is that something's got to be done, man. You know what I mean? And I even think the Republican Party now is in even more trouble. I've been watching the expose on the CIA activities under the Bush administration, and I mean, it's just amazing that the mentality of a Dick Cheney. I understand, you know, that there's some things that have to be done in order to bring about information, but, you know, when you see the level of beheadings that are going on in the Middle East, which is, you know, as ancient as the beginning of all time, the fact of the matter is, you know, you can't turn around and say that these people were wrong when you look at what went on in Guantanamo Bay under Bush, you know? And again, he's acting like as if he's in a vacuum, and he's defending the activities of people that he considered to be meritorious Americans, you know? I don't understand that at all.
Well, and also how no one seemingly, they were talking about the report that no one is held responsible. And that's kind of the thing. I mean, if somebody said, I okayed it because of this, this, and that, then, you know, you make a justification and a case for it.
Yeah.
But to just not, no one.
Everybody's passing the buck. And everybody down the dial at Fox, you know, they're all saying, oh, this is a highly political, they're doing this to distract attention to some of the real stories of the day. But to me, I mean, yeah, they were able to get Ferguson off the front page this week, but, I mean, it says a lot about them. And I think something like that needs to be exposed. You know, these were people that this country elected.
Let me say something else that we should never forget about, and that's the Emmett Till murder, massacre, and all, you know,
right.
But what they did to that young man a long time ago.
Right.
I'd like to bring up these names so people will not forget. Never forget.
Exactly.
You know, protest, get in the streets, make people live up to, you know, what this country is supposed to be all about. And it is. I don't even like, you know, it's very uncomfortable to constantly talk about racism and the negative, you know, negative feelings of people. But something's got to change because if not, you know, it's not going to be, it's not going to be comfortable for anybody to safely live in, period. So you see
no,
all the protests,
I agree.
You see all the demonstrations. So, you know, these young kids, they know what's going on. So, and then, and it's, you know, that was, talk about racism at its most viciousness. Emmett Till was one of the cases, okay?
Right.
As was Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, and the numbers of others. We could go down the list. And, you know, you get really so fed up with the things that are happening. You know, this happens. The Amadou Diallo thing, Sean Bell, you could go down the list. And so many people out there listening to me know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, and the thing is, you don't want to beat a drum every week talking about the same issues. And, I mean, certainly, you know, we're not without our own inimitable faults and stuff like that as a people. But you're absolutely right, Kay. I mean, we can't, the same way the Jewish community proudly will tell you that we cannot forget, you know, what they went through. You know, we need to remind our folks about some of the suffering, our own Holocaust, and the Holocaust that still exists today to a certain extent. And it doesn't mean that we're not, you know, progressive in our thoughts, that, you know, I embrace everybody, you know. I mean, the deal is that I want to make sure that at least anyone who I think favors me, I'm in favor of them. Doesn't matter what skin color it is. But the bottom line is that there is a disparity. I mean, there is empirical evidence. There are polls that have been conducted. You know, I walk out my house here in New York, especially at night, and there are times when I worry about whether I'm going to come back the same way. And it got nothing to do with my neighbor necessarily. It just goes on because of the climate of this town and the trigger happiness of some members of the police force. And some of them even look like me. That's the problem.
Let me take it in one different direction. You know what I'd like to see more of? I'd like to see more about what's happening in Harlem or in different places in the city. I'm talking about New York right now. Dealing with black theater. Remember when black theater was so popular? You know, and the different theater groups were, you know, really in the process of, you know, creating new things. And it was absolutely wonderful. And right now we have a lot of things on Broadway, not a lot, some things on Broadway that are doing, you know, with, you know, like things like The Lion King. I've seen The Lion King. It's absolutely wonderful. So there are so many good things to talk about. But the point is, every time you do that, something happens that causes the death of someone else of color, and then everything gets turned right. Your thinking turns around. You don't want to always have to think about the whole negative thing. But you can't forget it either.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think a lot of the problems in terms of our culture being promoted, whether it's on Broadway or on 125th Street, a lot of the things that are out there for young people to see are not affordable to the average person. I was looking to witness one of the shows downtown a couple of weeks ago. A friend of mine challenged me to go out and buy some Broadway tickets. When I saw the price, you know, I just said to myself, do I eat this week? Do I feed my hog? Or, you know, do I spend a night of merriment just watching entertainment?
Boy.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, the deal is that not everybody has access. You know, back in the day, Kay, I mean, we used to get all sorts of comp tickets for different things, but, you know, it's just crazy what goes on. And I'm just taken back, you know, how we are not in a position to support our own the way others may be able to go out there comfortably and support. I remember when Frank Sinatra could barely sing, but he would fill Radio City Music Hall. Here it is, Smokey Robinson is at Barclays tomorrow night, and I wonder if that theater is full, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it has a lot to do with cost.
I want to say one thing. I have to put in this plug for Cynthia Holliday. Cynthia Holliday is appearing, I think, the day after Christmas at, Count Basie? Is it Count Basie? No, what's the name of the club down? B.B. King? Is it B.B. King?
Oh, yeah, B.B. King's,
yeah. So she's a fantastic singer. She's from New Jersey, and I just wanted to let people know about that. And there's so many things going on downtown New York. It's absolutely fantastic. Eric, why don't you tell people about downtown New York?
I don't know what you're talking about. Why don't you tell
them? Okay, well, we're doing the Performing Arts Center. That's, they're finally, I think we're finally getting, Lincoln Center, a run for the money, because that was a question that the former director there had. He said that Lincoln Center was worried about the fact that the Performing Arts Center was taking, going to take the audiences. But listen, that's New York and New Jersey, but the Performing Arts Center is really, quite a place to go and so many good things.
From that perspective, I think the New Jersey Performing Arts Center has been around at least 10 years now. You would know more than I would, Mom, but I think it's been around for at least 10 years. And it's proven to be on par, almost on par, and at least for New Jersey, and have a really pretty good reputation from what I understand. I've never seen
excellent
any shows
really
there,
yeah.
But I understand that the PAC Center is a center that draws in quite a few people whenever they have their shows. So it's holding its own for the New Jersey, Northern New Jersey area.
And I think there's enough room for everybody. I think that a lot of people, I know if I lived in Jersey, I wouldn't want to pay $14 just to cross the bridge or go through the tunnel if I could see a quality act in my hometown. And and that's it. And it's a magnificent edifice. I mean, I really enjoy every time I go there. I also think that the PAC should be in New York somewhere, maybe in the Bronx or something. I know that's a bit of a just far fetched to even think of, bit of a stretch. So,
but downtown Newark is quite different from. We do have a problem in one part of Newark. However, downtown Newark is not like that. There's a new jazz club down there. There's WBGO down there. A whole lot of other good things downtown Newark. So, I like it. Congressman Donald Payne is down there.
Okay.
So when I say down there, he's all over the place, and he's doing quite well. Right, Eric?
Okay. I'll just try to follow that conversation. People meandering and they start pulling you down. But you are right, my kidding aside, Newark, the downtown area is starting to come back, and hopefully from a financial thing, is the rejuvenation of this city can help the residents in the city, and we can really hope to have some sort of business and industry that comes to Newark, where the average Newarker that's been there for years and generations can go and get a decent job, because there's still a large number of parts of the city that are still kind of in a depressed state, or just really trying to come out of that depression going into the Bush years.
Yeah.
So.
There was a scathing report on that earlier this week, I know, and I'm glad you pointed that out, but I mean, that doesn't, you shouldn't brand the entire city just based with what happens in one pocket, and that's it. It's a beautiful town. I had a chance to work over there at Rutgers University some years ago, and I, fell in love with Newark then. I don't really know the city that well, but I do know they protect the campus of Rutgers fairly good and anything near it.
It's the Center for Higher Education in the state of New Jersey. There are seven colleges,
you're right.
But we're running out of time.
Yeah, we're coming up on that time right about now. We've had a good discussion for the last hour talking about these issues, and also getting Wayne Gilman's perspective and his expertise over the years, and a conversation we definitely should continue, because I'd like to take the next time to interview you and my mother, Wayne, and talk about those days at WLIB, and maybe we can even have some other people with you. So I want to say thank you to Wayne Gilman. You want to let the people know who you are, sir, and sign off for us?
Thank you very much. I tell you, I'm really honored to even be at the spotlight tonight. I felt that you were almost like Ralph Edwards. Well, this predates you, Eric, but there was a show back in the 50s called This Is Your Life. And there used to be this guy named Ralph. I don't even know if Ralph Edwards is still alive, but, I'm good to be on every week, you know.
Thanks, Wayne.
Thank you, Wayne Gilman. And this
thank
is the K Thompson Live Show here on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can hear us live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. And you can also listen to the archived episodes of the shows here on the blogtalkradio.com. Go to /K Thompson Live, blogtalkradio.com, /K Thompson Live. You can hear the show every time. I'm the son, Eric Payne, and you
and
are.
I'm K Thompson.
Thanks for listening. We hope to hear you again listening next week on the K Thompson Live Show. See you then. Groove with it.